A Houston Adapt group is now organizing. If you're interested in peaceful protests, community outreach, and accessibility research and intervention, call 979-308-6407 to learn more. That number is 979-308-6407 to join the Houston chapter of Adapt and advocate for the civil rights of people with disabilities. All Adapt actions are nonviolent.
That unruffled beat of Clouds Below Your Knees by Ray Lynch signals 8 p.m. Thursday. Time for So What's Your Story, the only program originating in Houston devoted entirely to storytelling, right here on listener-sponsored KPFT 90.1 FM. I'm your host, Dr. Hank Rubicek, and alongside the best team on radio, Greg Audell, Drs. Warren Holloman, and Mary Edgerton, and tonight, Nick Allen, stepping in for Tatiana Gago as she continues her visit with family in Columbia. We celebrate the power of story by placing the spotlight on tellers who take us on astounding journeys before returning us safely to the present. You know, everyone has a favorite story, that tale you just can't listen to enough, that prodigious yet unexceptionable character, or maybe the story told to you at bedtime about 100 times. A favorite story is like a favorite movie. No matter how often it's watched, you see something different every time. Favorite story isn't always a great story. It's a story that resonates. It digs deep. It makes sense. I asked tonight's guests to tell a couple of their favorite stories from those they've crafted. The hardest part was asking them to limit the number of yarns because, as you will quickly discover, they are a gifted ensemble. Each have graced the studio before and are back because you love them and for good reason. They are Amanda Wenger, R.D. Vincent, and Justin Dice. How are everybody doing?
Awesome. How are you?
Doing awesome. Well. How are you?
Fantastic.
RD, you said that you thought they were being blackballed because you weren't called within a couple of weeks or what?
Well, it's been about a year and a half now.
It's been about a year and a half. Yeah. Yeah. But you were on the A-list. You were on the A-list, I promise. Right?
I was excited to get your email back.
I know. You know, people are very excited. They do this for the money primarily and for the prestige because this is now, as we know, broadcasted internationally. Welcome, Koreans. Yes. No, actually, I think we have a very large listening off, you know, not quite as large as we'd like, but it is not bad. All right. Now, before each of you deliver your favorite personally constructed stories, I want you to think a little bit generically about your favorite yarns, ones you've heard or read at some time somewhere. In a few words, just to give us a reference, what makes it a favorite? Amanda, what makes a story a favorite in your mind?
For me, it's about transformation. So there needs to be something changing, something dynamic about the story.
A character or you?
A character. Or okay. Me, if I'm the character. Yeah. And in terms of personal stories, my favorite stories are about weird travel experiences,
good.
Which I guess I like because I get to live them again.
But transformation is the key.
Yes.
Right? You've got to be different.
Yes.
It's got to be dynamic. It has to evolve. Justin, what about you?
I think I'm all about endings. I think a good, satisfying ending really makes a story. So that's what I really look for in my favorite stories.
They lived happily ever after. You like those stories?
Not necessarily in those words, but... But something that kind of comes full circle.
Okay. So you need closure.
Yes.
You probably are not a sequel guy.
Preferably not. No.
Okay, there you go. See, there you go. There you go. RD, what about you? What makes it a favorite?
I like originality. I think it's interesting when there's something that's never been told before and you're finally hearing it for the first time.
How do you gauge originality?
It's funny, like I write American fables and, you know, they're all based on my family's 300 years in America. And, you know, that's intriguing to me, you know, that they've survived that long.
And we're going to be talking about that later.
Yeah.
And that's really a great point, because I've always loved fables because they really do personify the human experience. You know, most are animals, but they're much more realistic, I think, than stories that actually characterize people.
Absolutely.
But we're going to talk about that just a little bit later. This kind of sets the tone for tonight. So let's get to your stories. These favorites are original stories, stories that you constructed to be told, or in RD's case, to be read. Amanda, let's start with you. You're a nurse, a storyteller, and you are a regular participant at the Moth here in Houston. I've heard you tell lots of stories, and I just love everyone that you've told.
Oh,
genuinely. That's why you guys are here. When did you first refer to yourself as a storyteller? I know that when I asked you guys to send me a brief bio, you said that you, at one point, referred to yourself as a storyteller, gave yourself that label.
Well, it's been a long time. I mean, I started out as a kid just sort of telling stories at the dinner table.
Yeah.
And that evolved into family picnics, family gatherings. I would dress up in costumes and entertain my cousins who were all younger. I did this one bit where, and picture me at about 9 years old, I did this one bit where I was an old lady. And I did put on my little ruffled cap and I said, "When I was your age."
How do you know if audience is engaged in your story?
If they're laughing or gasping, or pretty much just if they're looking at you.
You know, one of the things that I notice about all of you, really, since you've been on before, and this is especially true for Justin and Amanda, because I've watched them rather than simply heard them and met them, and there's kind of a signature style that all of you own, which I think is terrific. And I think we're going to hear them tonight in all of your stories. I think that vintage Amanda tells stories fueled by intensity and raw emotion. That's my own
impression. I think you're right.
Yeah. And I admire the permission that you give yourself, because I think we all have to give ourselves permission to tell stories. We have to have that sense of ownership. If we don't give ourselves permission, there's something missing. And you really tell very revealing narratives as a result. Now, both tonight's stories were told of the Moth. Your first takes place in an Icelandic shipyard, and it's entitled All of This Done with Love. Tell us your story.
That's right. My mother was convinced I would die in Iceland. "There are killers out there," she said. I said, "Who? All five people in Iceland can't be killers." "People," she said. "Strangers." She's used to the violence we see in the news in America, so I forgive her fantasies of nonspecific killers. But a couple years ago, I decided that I really wanted to see the world, and I have a very flexible schedule as a nurse, but I didn't know anybody who wanted to go to the same places or who could go at the same time. So I read a lot of travel blogs, and I decided I want to go to Iceland. Told my mom this, she freaked out. She said, "Not by yourself, not to Iceland, might as well be the end of the world." I said, "Mom, I'm going. I already booked it." So I did, and I just bought myself a backpacking backpack and went for it. And it's a beautiful country. There's a lot to do outdoors, and it also has a reputation of being very safe. So I took a few risks that perhaps I would not have taken had I been a savvier traveler or had I not known of this reputation for safety. I love going to plays, and every time I go somewhere, I try to sign up for some sort of theater experience. So I bought tickets online for this thing called Phoenix that they were doing in an Icelandic shipyard. It was just outside of Reykjavik, and it was run by a Danish theater company, and it was supposed to be sort of an immersive theater experience where you don't so much buy a ticket as you buy a time slot. Everyone has their individual time slot every 15 minutes. So I show up there with my backpack, which has all of my stuff in it, my passport, my money, my phone, everything. And I get there, and it's just a shipping crate. I just show up to the shipping crate, and there's a Danish man and woman, both with beautiful long blonde hair, and they say, "Oh, hey, good to see you. Let me see your ticket." "Great. Well, you can leave your stuff in the shipping crate, and we'll get started." And I said, "Wait, you mean to tell me that you want me, a first-time traveler, to Iceland by myself to leave all of my possessions that I have and require to get back home with you strangers in this shipping crate?" And he said, "Yes." And I said, "Okay, So I did. I left my pack with them, and he took me outside, and he fitted me with a GPS tracker and a set of headphones. And he said, okay, this is what you're going to do. I'm going to turn on your GPS, and at your start time, you're going to follow this course around the shipyard, and it is illuminated by some white stones. You have to also understand that this is at dusk. So we're in this shipyard. Not many people are around. It looks kind of abandoned down at the waterfront. And he said, you're going to start on this track, and when you hit certain places in the course, your GPS will kick in, and via headphones, you'll get a little more of the story, and it will tell you where to go. So I put on my stuff, and he says one more thing. None of this is meant to frighten you. All of this is done with love. And that freaked me out a little bit, but I said, all right, here we go. So I started on the course, started laying in a nest of twigs in a wheelbarrow on the ground. And as I lay there, the GPS kicked in and it started playing me some music and the sound of waves and poetry. And then I got out of this nest and I started to follow the course. I met some very interesting and dynamic characters along the way. Most of them did not speak to me at all. One stop along the way led me to a hut with a woman building a fire, and she invited me non-verbally to help her build this fire. One was a laughing man in a red hat who I laughed and darted around the shipyard, and I had to chase him in between enormous pallets of lumber just to get to my next destination on the course. And one woman danced with me. And one place in the course led me to a boat where there was a woman inside, and she put salt in my hand and told me a story about a bird that flew and flew and flew over a world of endless water, searching for land. And only once she laid her egg did she discover that land was inside, and that's where she could rest. But the last stop on the course was a truck bed. I got to this truck, and there was a note in the front of the truck. It was this abandoned truck in the shipyard, and it said, follow the rope. And the rope led to the back of the truck bed. So I go back there, climb some old tires to get in, open the door, followed the rope inside, and once the doors closed behind me, it was completely black. And I started to freak out a little bit. I thought, okay, I'm alone, I'm in this foreign country, I've left all of my stuff with strangers, what's going on? But I kept following the rope to the back, I'm assuming, of the truck bed, and turned around to follow it back towards the door when I started to hear some breathing very close by. And it was this oceanic breath. And as the breathing got closer, I stopped, and I felt a presence standing right in front of me, and I could feel salt air wafting into my face. And rationally, I understood that this must be one of the other actors, and they were probably wearing some sort of mask or apparatus so that the air they were pushing towards me smelled like salt. But for a moment, time seemed to stop, and it felt as if I was in the presence of a ghost. And then that person took my hand. And I remembered what this Danish stranger told me. He said, all of this is done with love. None of this is meant to scare you. And I knew that this was the moment he meant. And so I just stood there and breathed with this ghost of the ocean. And after what could have been a minute, what could have been an hour, they let go of my hand and retreated. And I followed the rope back out of the truck bed and to the end of the course. And I got my pack from the shipping container, and everything was exactly where I had left it. And I sat around and chatted with some of the other people who had been going through this course. The world is not as scary as it seems, is what I learned. And wow. Doing this by myself, I think, was a huge boon to me.
Yeah. Oh, my God. Okay. It's safe. You know, I know you well enough to know that you care about safety.
Yeah. Oh, yes.
Yeah. Right. I struck a funny bone there. Yeah. Although it's not funny, but you care about safety and you love traveling, right?
Yes.
Okay. Now, so I know what inspires the story, but this is an important question. What inspires you to tell the story?
Something, as I said earlier, something mm-hmm. dynamic has to happen. Something has to change.
Yeah.
There has to be some sort of growth. I was thinking about this earlier when you asked, you know, what stories I wanted to tell. I was thinking about my favorite experiences, and one of the best things I've ever done was go hiking on the Isle of Skye. It was incredible, like one of my biggest, fondest memories ever in my life. But when I think about that moment, is it a story? No. Absolutely not, because nothing changed. I got there, I hiked, it was beautiful. I went up, I went down, but I didn't meet anyone interesting. I didn't learn anything about myself.
Yeah.
So when I think about my favorite experiences, it's not so much, is it sad, is it funny? It's more, did something change? Because that
changed.
Is what grips people about a story.
That's a great insight. It sounds obvious, but it really isn't. It really isn't. I think a lot of your stories are about change. They may not be as explicit, but let's listen to some more and see if we can draw some kind of a thread. Michigan native Justin Dice is an educator at Advantage Testing of Houston, which has delivered educational services to Houston's scholastic community for over 20 years. He also won the Moth Grand Slam last week with a beautiful story that you're about to enjoy. And as a veteran academic, I've got hundreds of stories of students, achievement, failure, and everything in between. And this is really kind of tough to answer just a few words. But I'm going to ask you to try, Justin. But what is it that, what's the most essential characteristic do you think students are missing that keeps them from achieving academic success, other than laziness and illiteracy?
Right. So
right.
You give me the
lack of support.
One. Right.
Immaturity.
I think faith in one's ability to learn.
Yeah.
I think faith in one's ability to learn. Yeah.
Right.
So you know, understanding that you know, if you put forth the effort, growth is possible. It's not just intelligence is not a set thing.
And, you know, just like I mentioned to Amanda, that sounds really simple, but it's not. It's really mm-hmm. profound. You know, everybody doesn't have to achieve on the same level, but those who work harder should achieve more. It's really a matter of desire and effort. You know, no one's given a free ride. That's a terribly overly used cliche, but I think it really does apply in so many cases. Listen, again, congratulations for last week's story. You know, I've heard you tell several stories, and I'm always impressed by the way that you let a story unfold. You have a way of telling a story like it's never been told before, complete with what I refer to as place hesitancy, you know, like you even know when to hesitate or sound reluctant, as if you haven't told the story before. And that really impresses me a lot. I think last week's story showcased all of this and a lot more, and it's called A Midsummer's Night Dream. Everybody out there, we're not talking Shakespeare, but close.
So I met Suzanne walking down cobblestone streets on warm July evenings in Cambridge, England. We were both studying abroad that summer, and we discovered that we were the only two people in our creative writing class that lived in the dorms furthest from campus. So every day we made it a ritual to walk to class together. And over the course of 2 months, I found that not only was Suzanne gorgeous, but that she also had a biting wit. She got this wry little smile on her face before she said something clever. She was brave and ambitious and kind, and soon to be engaged to her boyfriend of 5 years. So as hard as I felt for Suzanne that summer, I didn't say anything, because she was with someone, and I knew it would be wrong. Over the next couple years, Suzanne and I kept up, and I heard about her move to Northern California. I heard about her breakup with his boyfriend, and I heard it when she met her new boyfriend, Lars, or whatever. He was a Norwegian ski instructor. He had a great beard. And 2 years later, I gave her a call, and I said, "You know, hey, Suzanne, I'm going to be traveling this summer. I'm going to be in California for a bit. Are you around? Do you want to hang out?" She said, "Absolutely." She said, "Actually, I'm selling everything I own, going on a 2-week road trip around the state, and then moving to Norway to be near Lars and start grad school." She said, "Do you want to come on the road trip?" And I thought, well, that doesn't seem like an emotional minefield. Yep, I'm over her. So I said, "Yes." And that summer, I fly up to California, and Suzanne and I start our adventure together. A few days in, we're up in the Sierra Nevada mountains in this cute little mountain town, and it's my birthday. So we go out, we get this gourmet dinner, we get a bottle of wine, and we drive up to this scenic overlook that we've heard about. We get up there with the only two people around, and the moon is full, and the stars are bright. And Suzanne and I sit on the hood of her beat-up Toyota Corolla, and we share this wine, and we look out on the scene of the mountains at night. And I look over at her, and we're hanging out, and she's laughing, and the moonlight's in her hair, and I think, uh-oh, I've not over her. In fact, I'm on the most romantic date of my life with her, and for the next 2 weeks I'm going to be stuck in a car with her. And she's with someone. And as much as I want to in that moment, I don't say anything. We finish our wine, and we go back down the mountain. A few days later, we end up in Lake Tahoe, and we see Shakespeare on the beach underneath the setting sun with the crystal clear blue waters as the backdrop and the mountains all around us. And it's a Midsummer Night's Dream, and the coincidence is not lost on me. And in the middle of the play, we're laughing, we're having a great time. I look over at Suzanne, she looks back and she smiles at me, and it feels like a hot knife goes through my chest. We end up going next to Napa Valley. We go wine tasting. We go to San Francisco. We get great sushi. We go to Monterey. We find our childhood home. We end up on the coast in Big Sur on this cliff overlooking the ocean. And I remember imagining that if Lars were there, I could maybe give him a little push and see how well he and his beard could ski down a sheer cliff face. But it's just the two of us, and we look out at the ocean, and we see in the distance there's this pod of whales breaching. And a little closer, there's this school of dolphins that are racing around. And right by the shore, there's this pod of seals that are laughing, or not laughing, barking and playing in the waves. And Suzanne's standing next to me, and she says, "I've lived in California my entire life, and I've never seen anything like this. This is really special." And we stand there for 3 hours. We're quiet. And it's perfect. And it's agony. Over the last couple of days, we've had these moments, these looks, these comments where I start to think, does Suzanne know how I feel? And more than that, how does she feel about me? And we're standing on the edge of this cliff with the wind in our hair and the ocean at our feet, and she's with someone. And I don't say anything. We spent the last couple of days of our trip in San Diego, and we're on the beach and with all of her friends, but all I can think about is the fact that in a few days she's going to go to Norway, and I don't know if I'm ever going to see her again. And the last day comes, and Suzanne drives me to the bus station. This whole 2 weeks, this heat has been building this pressure has been building in my chest, and the hot knife has turned into this molten ball of lead, and I just have to get it out. And we get to the bus station, and we're waiting in line, and we're talking about just the most amazing 2 weeks that we've had together. We spent every moment together. It's been unforgettable. And just how rare it is to find someone with whom you connect so naturally. We get up to the bus, and I throw my bag underneath, and I turn, and Suzanne gives me a big hug. She pulls back, and she looks at me for a second. She says, "I love you, Justin." And I finally get to say what I've been meaning to say, but I don't get to say it how I mean it. And I look back at her and I say, "I love you too, Suzanne." And we're quiet again. But it's a different sort of quiet. Before I turn and I get on the bus and I ride away.
Yeah, I love that story. You guys see what I mean by these perfect imperfections, hesitancies, right? You all do it. I think most good storytellers do, but you do it very, very, very well. That's what I mean by it unfolding naturally. Yeah, women fall in love with guys named Lars, Rod, Buck, Milton.
Chad.
I don't, John?
Mm-hmm. Chad.
Chad? Brother. Okay. Thank you, Amanda, for sharing that with us. Chad. Let's not forget about Chad. There's always a Chad that women love, right, Chad? Now, getting back to you for just a moment. Mm-hmm. This story is, obviously, it's a great story. First of all, Amanda, did you ever love a guy named Chad?
No, I'm
okay,
kidding.
Okay, I'm just wondering.
It just seems like a name,
Now that I've insulted her, I just want to make sure it's not the love of her life or something. It could be your German Shepherd for all I know. I have no idea. How do you feel when you tell the story? And you know what I'm asking. In other words, I'm not asking you why do you tell. How do you feel when you tell it? What comes to mind?
Well, other than the brief moment of kiss her, you idiot. I think, honestly, grateful for having had the opportunity to have these great experiences that turned into stories, and also grateful to know people with whom, again, you connect really well, even if it is in the way that you hope or intend in the moment.
Right. Well said. Well said. R.D., born in Hudson Valley, for those of you who failed geography, that's New York.
That'd be correct.
Okay, good. Very good. R.D. writes folk tales. He's published 8 books, all of which based on tales his grandmother told him growing up. He's finishing his 9th of his Donbridge series that features a storytelling grandma who shares fables while cooking. My grandmother did that all the time. I used to ask her, what's for dinner? And she would say, let me tell you the story about the little boy in the carnival. And I had to sit there for 20 minutes until I realized that the story was about never asking her what was for dinner again, right? I don't know. Grandmothers are just notorious at that. Now, unlike many folktellers and writers, R.D. effortlessly inserts the ingredients for a successful folktale and fable. He finds a way to keep customs and traditions alive. He unleashes a parable at unsuspecting moments, and he manages to personify the human experience with wisdom and wit. R.D.'s stories focus on Donbridge. Now, I've asked you this before, but tell us, what is Donbridge?
Well, Donbridge was a way that I could create a fabled folktale town in the Hudson Valley, the first ever of New York, and it was a way that I could take all of her stories and encompass them in that town's history of over 300 years for that town.
Wow. Wow.
And it's kind of like the Brigadoon of New York, if you would.
Yeah.
So
it's an incredible historical documentation.
Yeah, I think I'm over 50 fables now.
And, gosh.
And
so many of them got Donbridge in them.
Yeah. Let's
start with the wasps of Donbridge. I don't want to insult anybody out there. We're not talking about insects, but you'll explain.
So
if it was really a wasp, we'd call the SWAT team.
So on Saturday mornings in our town, it was always garage sale day. And we would always head out to my grandparents' house because my grandmother was always having a list out ready to go. And she'd have an entire list of garage sales from here to Timbuktu of where we were going to travel all over the entire area. And my great aunt would always be pulling into the driveway right behind her. And this morning she had chocolate chip cookies ready to go in her antique tin that had the latest version of the last 1800 Sears Roebuck catalog on it. And so we'd head out into the car and we'd head out into the wilderness, if you will. And my grandfather always before we left, where are you headed? I said, wherever the wind takes us. And we'd head off down the road. And just one day we were looking around to some estate sales and we were climbing into the mountaintops of the Schwangup mountain range. And we had found a sign that was just off in the side and one sign after another sign. So we just kept following these signs. And eventually, after about 3 or 4 miles, we thought we'd never reach the end to find out where this estate sale was. But finally, we reached an old driveway that was cascading down into the mountain range, which overlooked the entire valley. And so my grandmother turned the wheel, and we headed down the driveway. And not about, I'd say, 100 feet that we got through the driveway, she stopped the car. And all in front of us, every ash tree was destroyed. All the trees were barren. Not a single one had leaves, bark. The entire forest was just decimated. And my grandmother was in shock at this because she had not seen devastation like this for years. And, you know, she said, I guess the emerald ash borers have really taken down everything in this forest, because I remember being in this forest as a child and it was nothing like what it is now. It's gone. So I started to ask her, you know, a little bit about it and where they came from, and she started to tell me a story. And she told me a story in Dunbridge of a general store that was named Sharp's General Store, and they would get mercantile crafts, plates, silks, everything from all over the world, and they would always be shipped in wooden crates from wherever they came from. And so this store would house all this stuff and be the trade commerce of the entire town. Well, you know, the local sheriff knew that this woman would always, Mrs. Sharp, would always get these crates in with all these different mercantiles. So he decided he was going to go down and collect some of these crates and build himself a wagon from them because he was going to go collect firewood in the woods. So he went down, got himself a couple crates, and started crafting himself a wagon, according to my grandmother. When he was done with his wagon, after about a week, he hitched it up to his horse, and he headed out into the forest. And as he was traveling along, these emerald green bugs were flying all around him and he'd flick them off every now and again, as he would. And never thought anything of it. And as he entered the forest edge, he found some fallen trees and decided he was going to go chop them. And as he did, he started to notice that the wagon he had was filled with these metallic green bugs, and he had no idea what they were. And so he went about his business, and as he did, he started to see them beeline to every ash tree in the entire forest. Well, the funny thing about this was is he didn't think it was a big deal, so he ignored it and just figured, heck, they're off my car, or off my wagon, I don't need to worry about it. So he went about his business. Well, a month later, he came back to the forest, and just as my grandmother had seen, the entire forest was decimated. Well, he knew right away when he saw the bugs that they had all encompassed the entire forest, and he knew that they had come in somewhere, possibly from where he brought them in from the wagon. So he went and sought out his mother, who was the midwife in the town. And she was always the solver of problems. She could solve anything. In fact, when he ran out, when he took his horse out to go meet his mother, she was out there nursing a young piglet back to health that was suffering from some kind of ailment, and she was trying to break the fever of the pig with a heavy blanket. And he explained the situation to her, and his mother quickly, you know, hopped a horse, and the two of them rode off in the forest because she wanted to inspect the bugs for herself. So she was checking them out and looking at them, and they're flying all over the place. And she knew immediately what they were. Well, she took off and left everyone behind and disappeared for over a week. And no one ever heard from her. Then all of a sudden she came back and she had 30 gold discs with her. And she sat there with those gold discs in the middle of the forest. And she slowly opened up each disc and a little black cloud would emerge from every little gold disc that she had. And they took off. They were these tiny wasps, and they were flying all throughout the entire forest. And as they did, they were landing upon these bugs, and all of a sudden, every single one of these bugs started falling from the trees, dying right where they were. Soon after, all those bugs were gone. No one ever heard anything of it. As my grandmother finished the story, my great aunt was in the back eating the chocolate chip cookies, and she decided she was going to get out of the car. Now, the story that I told you took place over 200 years ago. And when my great aunt had gotten out of the car, I had watched her get out and shut the door. And as I looked back at my great aunt, she pulled a gold disc from her pocket and opened it up. And I saw for a second this little black cloud. And moments later, the emerald ash borer started falling from the trees, landing on the hood of the car. My grandmother just smiled at me. And we drove off down the road to the garage sale.
Wow. All right. This was one of the stories that, you know, spun by your grandmother. How old were you when you first heard the story that inspired this one?
It's funny. You know, she started telling them when we were six, seven years old.
Right,
and, you know, this one here probably around when I was 10.
Yeah.
That was 30 years ago.
Yeah. Right. Right.
Yeah.
Sure. Thank you. Right.
Yeah.
Thank you. Yeah. I tell everybody, you know, that I was at U of H for 37 years. I started when I was six. I tell them that all the time, right? I gotcha. Now, there are parables in every folktale, right? That's one of the characteristics. What's the single most important lesson from the story?
I think the thing is that we become very myopic and so focused on ourselves and in our own little world that we don't realize that sometimes the actions that we take could affect the greater whole.
Yeah.
And it's interesting by that, but I think the interesting thing, too, is like just the even how small the aunt is just eating in the back of the car the cookies, and you think nothing of her.
Right.
And then all of a sudden, she's carrying the very weapon that's going to save everybody in her pocket the entire time.
Yeah. So. Oh, yeah. Before we get started, this is Hank Rubicek with Nick Allen stepping in for Tatiana, and you are listening to Our Favorite Stories with guest storytellers Amanda Wenger, Justin Dice, and R.D. Vinson on KPFT 90.1 FM Houston, 89.5 in Galveston, and 91.9 with our friends in Huntsville. We're going to kind of give a synthesized version of announcements tonight because I've gotten wordier than usual. We got some great stories to listen to. You know, Nick's been working the boards for Wally James Progressive Forum for a long time, but he's also a music professor at San Jac. He's got a music program right here on KPFT. Nick, how you doing? Tell us a little bit about your music show, just the name, day, time, what you got going.
Yes, the music show starts at 12 a.m.
Midnight.
Yes, on Monday mornings.
All right.
So actually, my friends in Germany, they tend to listen. So this is their morning show for in Germany, and especially
right.
in Berlin.
Aha.
As for the name of the show is called The Taste with Nick Allen. It gives you a taste of a lot of indie music from all of Houston's greatest musicians and songwriters and singers.
Beautiful.
And composers who are here in the city, and I play specifically their music.
Great. Magnificent. We're going to listen to you. Nick, thank you so much mm-hmm. for stepping in. You could be home, except I'm not allowing you to. So I just want you to know how much I appreciate
not
it.
A problem.
I really do. I do. Listen, we want all of our listeners to join our family of story lovers and make us a weekly habit. You don't need a radio to enjoy our program. Just listen online at www.kpft.org. You can also find us on Facebook, Instagram, and YouTube. Frankly, we're all over the place. And if you've got any program ideas, guests, ideas, contacts, even if it means you, we want to hear from you. Just drop us a note at story@kpft.org, and we promise to get back to you. Our sponsor, the Houston Storytellers Guild, they are magnificent. Get online at www.houstonstorytellers.org. And while you're there, think about becoming a member and listen to our programs way back from 2008. Just go to radio program, click on it, and enjoy it. And there are hundreds there, so you better get started. Our friends of the Moth hold a story slam at Warehouse Live, typically on the second Tuesday of the month. So get your tickets at themoth.org. Get ready for stories about being bold on July 9th. Justin, we know, rocked the stage, taking the gold at the Grand Slam last week, and that is a hard, hard thing to do. Amanda, myself, Greg, other co-hosts, just a lot of folks have been doing it, and we know it can be nerve-wracking. So again, congratulations, Justin. In the meantime, let's get back to some stories. I'm Hank Rubicek, and you are listening to So What's Your Story? Only on 90.1 Pacifica Radio, fueled for peace. You know, among the list of skills owned by Amanda, let's add her knack for fusing a mysterious theme with the surreal. I hope my impressions are right, because I'm really talking you up here, right?
Yeah.
All of
no,
you.
No, you're
all right. Tell us your story called Seance.
So I went to a seance in Scotland a couple years ago. It was run as part of the Edinburgh Fringe Festival, which takes place in August every year. Which is a big, big theater and art festival. So when I travel, as I mentioned earlier, I love going to some sort of live performance. So I thought, well, I've never been to a seance. And the blurb online looked great. It said, we've got a local medium coming. So I said, all right, let's do it. And when I got to town, I told the friend I was staying with about it. And she said, man, that sounds fun. Can you see if I can get a ticket? But they were all booked up. And when I got to the seance, I understood why. There were 6 seats at the table, not counting the seat for the medium. I got in there a couple minutes early, sat around the table. Medium hadn't arrived yet. We were in this old, old stone building. If you know anything about Edinburgh, it's very atmospheric. It's a little spooky if you're there on a misty, rainy night, which I was. There's all these stone archways, these winding alleyways through town. So I sat inside one of these buildings at a table with 5 other strangers. And we made introductions. To my left was a local hairstylist. To my right was another local who was in construction. There was a tourist couple across the table. And then directly across from me, there was who seemed to be a college kid. Looked like he was a student at the local university because he had a sweatshirt on with the logo. So we were sitting around, and the stylist goes, oh my gosh, this guy is great. I go see him every month. He knows things you would not believe. So I thought, cool, all right, well, I'm ready. I did not introduce myself to anyone as a nurse, at this venue. And the reason is I didn't want anyone, particularly the medium, I didn't want anybody to cold read me and decide that they should pretend to contact one of my patients. I do work in critical care, and sometimes my patients die, and I thought it would be a little bit morbid for someone to be suggesting that they could contact a person that I had cared for. So I just gave my name and where I was from, but didn't tell them my profession. So the door opens, the great such and such arrives. He's decked out in this very suave-looking suit. Very debonair. He sits down. He says, "Welcome. It's so good to see you all, friends. I'm so glad that you're here. I have a message for one of you." And he looks at College Kid and he says, I'm getting an M. I'm sensing an M. Is there someone who might want to talk to you with a name that starts with M or has M in it somewhere or is from a place that begins with the letter M?" And I'm like, all right, this is another cold read, right? He's just sort of throwing out something and hoping that it'll stick. Now, I'm not that person, guys, at performances. I am never, never here to step on anyone's toes. So I was not about to make any exclamations of disbelief. I thought, you know, it's a performance. Even if the other people here believe in what's happening, I can just treat it like a show. And College Kid looks pretty skeptical, but he looks at the medium, the great such and such, and goes, "Well, I mean, there's my roommate, Mike, who died last year." And the medium goes, "Yes, it's Mike. It's Mike. I can sense Mike. We are going to contact Mike. But first, I need someone to tie me to this chair. Because when I contact the spirit realm, the spirits take over my body, and sometimes I end up convulsing." So he gets the construction worker to tie him to this chair. He says, "Sir, I can tell that you're a strong man. I want you to tie the ropes as tight as you can without hurting me." And the construction worker looks a little puzzled, but he goes, "Oh, all right, mate." And he does it. And then the lights dim even further, and the medium asks us to hold hands around the table. And he begins attempting to contact the spirit world. And the table starts to shake, and the lights begin to flicker. And we start hearing loud thumping noises from the panels in the walls of the room around us. And I'm thinking, wow, the special effects around here are pretty good. And I look around the table and everyone's terrified. They are losing it. The woman next to me is praying. The guy to my right is sort of rocking back and forth. And the great such and such begins convulsing in his chair. And he convulses so hard that he tips backwards onto the floor and stops moving. Everyone's freaking out. I look across the table. College Kid looks terrified. And I think, all right, I understand that this is a performance, but a man who is tied to a chair just tipped backwards onto a hard stone floor and now he's not moving. I have got to do something. So amidst all of this chaos, I stand up, the lights are flickering, the walls are thumping, and I say, "Don't worry, I'm a nurse, I will help him," and I start to move towards the great such and such. And everything stops. The lights come on, the thumping ceases. Everybody kind of looks at me like, what are you doing? Everybody stops looking panicked, and they just kind of stare at me. And the great such and such opens his eyes and kind of gives me a little eye roll like, "What are you doing to me here?" And I said, I wanted to make sure you were okay, but I can tell now that clearly you're fine. I'm sorry, I'm a little embarrassed. And the construction worker to my right looks at me and very matter-of-factly says, "What's the matter, lady? It's just a show. Sit down." Only he was Scottish, so it was more like, "What are you doing, lass? Sit down." And that's the moment I realized that every single person in the room was an actor. I was the only audience member at this show. And that is why my friend could not get a ticket. Everyone seems so disappointed. They didn't get to make it to the end of the act. College Kid, looking bored again, kind of sits, crosses his arms and says, "Yeah, we didn't even make it to my possession. Like I had stepped on his drum solo, and now I'm just embarrassed." I'm like, "I'm so sorry. I'm so, so sorry. No, please continue. I will sit. I will not say a word." And they're like, "Yeah, yeah, yeah, yeah. Get out of here. Show's over. It's over." So I left and I walked back through the stone streets with the fog, and I looked around and everything felt a lot less atmospheric. So many people can say that they've been to a seance, but not many can say that they've ruined one.
That's right. Beautiful. Beautiful. And he was convulsing. Yeah. I went to a psychic once and she was convulsing, but not nearly as much as I was convulsing when I got her bill. Yeah. Yeah. Convulsing. I love it. I love it. Now, in one sentence, this is going to be tough. Somebody says to you, Amanda, I love your stories, but you know what? I'm not interesting enough to have any stories. What do you say to that person?
Everyone's interesting to someone else.
Nice. 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 Good. Nobody doesn't like something, but everybody likes Sara Lee. That's right. Remember that commercial? That's what it reminds me of. But all of you are way too young, right? Including Amanda. You're not? No, you're not. Oh, that's right. You lied about your age earlier inadvertently, Ray. I forgot about that. I forgot. Well, as long as we're talking to you and the fact that you're lying about your age, tell us about the Wandering Horse of Donbridge.
So my grandparents had a lean-to barn in the back of their property, far in the back, and my grandfather would keep boat engines, broken down motorcycles, Model T parts galore that were from every other Model T that lost a fender, lost a hubcap, was down there. But in the far off corner were horse bridles, which were hung in a corner that were almost molding away and needed some horse saddle soap, if you will. So he decided we were going to go clean them that day. So he took them down from the corner of the garage, and they had no horse at the farm anymore. And we marched our way up to the kitchen, and my grandmother was inside the kitchen working on baking a carrot cake. And she's going away, sitting there peeling the carrots as we're going ahead, soaping these saddles. Well, as we're soaping the saddles, she decides that she's going to tell us a story about this horse that she knew of in Donbridge. Well, it was long ago that the Lenape people had inhabited all of the Hudson Valley, before all the settlers had come, before the Dutch, before the English. And there was this boy who had a horse, and they were very close to both of them. You know, he very much bonded with his horse, just as much as anyone would bond with a dog, if you would. And well, one day, there was a grizzly bear that had come into their village and was terrorizing children, families, and destroying everything. And well, this brave boy decided him and his horse were going to pretty much take this grizzly bear out. Well, the boy, the horse, and the grizzly bear met the grizzly bear, and they started to engage each other, if you will. And well, the boy got knocked off the horse and hit his head against a tree. Well, the horse continued to fight the grizzly bear and actually knocked the grizzly bear out. But in the process, when it had kicked the grizzly bear and the boy had just woke up to witness this, the horse had fallen off a ravine right next door to where they were. The boy was distraught. The grizzly bear had taken off, and the boy climbed down to the ravine to see his horse. When he arrived at the bottom of the gorge, there was no horse to be found. Well, years passed, and the Lenape people had left the Hudson Valley, and English settlers had come in after the Dutch, and Donbridge was founded. Well, there was a baker who had a daughter. His name was Maggie Bloom. Her name was Maggie Bloom, and she was out for her morning strolls through the valley, and she had worked her way up into the forest. Well, she was walking along the river and decided to go across the footbridge. Well, the footbridge gave out, and she fell through, and she starts... since it was high water season, she's drowning in this river because she can't swim. And she's just about ready to go under, and this horse with a black diamond on its head reaches down and physically grabs her out of the water with its teeth and drags her to the shore. When she turns, the horse is gone. Well, months later, these two trappers were clearing out beaver traps because they were hunting beavers in the forest, and a mountain lion had come upon the two of them and was terrorizing the both of them. They were trying to get rid of this mountain lion, but in the end, the mountain lion seemed to be taking them out pretty easily. So all of a sudden, this horse came out of nowhere and careened into the mountain lion, sending the mountain lion flying. And when the two went to go see, you know, what had happened, the horse was gone. months later, there was a man who had all of his horses had perished, and he was a vegetable gardener in the town. Well, he had no way to plow his field, so he decided he was going to hook up his plow to himself and plow his own fields. But before he did that, a horse appeared out of nowhere, and this horse, too, had a black diamond on its head. And the horse was gesturing for him to hook the plow up to him. So he plowed all of his fields, and when he went to wipe his brow to go look back at the horse was gone. Well, my grandmother finished the story. You know, I looked up from the table, and she says, "Do you mind taking these carrot peels out to the backyard?" And I said, "Sure." She had a compost pile, and I headed on back there, and as I'm dumping the carrot peels all about, a horse with a black diamond on its head appears and starts eating the carrots. And when I went to look, the horse had vanished, but my grandmother shouting, "Just let the horse finish the peelings. Come back inside. The carrot cake's almost ready." That's it.
What does your grandmother say to kind of inspire this little ditty?
You know, it's funny. I think a lot of the things I started to get into, making a lot of the tales, try to gel, if you will, with a lot of the experiences I had on the farm and with her. So when I saw something, it would generate a story in my head.
Yeah.
Because I needed to, as a child, sometimes I would even make stories up to try to fit into why something was happening. You tend to do that. And I've just had like this kind of like overactive imagination that just has followed me my whole life to try to, you know, gel that whole idea to make sense of everything that I witnessed.
Yeah. Well, you know, your grandmother had, I think, a lot more influence than you even thought in way.
Yeah, absolutely.
And you tell these stories great. I know you were asking me, should I read them or tell them? You read them last time, but you have a great ability of sharing these. Really a great ability, you know, no difference as far as expression. These are great.
Yeah, it's
comfortable.
Funny. Thank you. I never really wanted to, you know, tell stories and wrote as much, but when I started going on the road traveling the country, you can't just read to people. You have to tell them the story.
Yeah, you really do. It really helps. And that's what the three of you do so well. Justin, the name of your second story arouses more curiosity than a personal letter from Publisher's Clearinghouse. Tell us the tale of Vicodin at Bible study. Did I get that right?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I thought so. I was afraid of that. Let's hear it.
So if you've never shown up to a Bible study that you're leading, reeking of weed, might be a better person than I am. It was the beginning of my sophomore year of college. It was the beginning of my time as a resident assistant in my dorm. And it was the beginning of this Bible study that I was leading with my best friend, James. We were going to be leading a Bible study for freshman guys, and I was really excited to hopefully you make this a year of diving deep into God's Word together and learning together and, a meaningful time for the people involved. But on this particular day, on the day of our third or fourth Bible study, we had an RA training event. Because it turned out one of our jobs as an RA was to prevent people from doing drugs in the dorm. This was a problem for me, since the innocent little cherub that I was, I had never smelled marijuana before. So since this was the case for several other members of the staff, they took us all over to the campus police station, out down to the basement, where the cop lit what presumably was a confiscated joint, and walked around the room and held it up so we could all smell it. He got about halfway around the room to my friend Shyama, who was sitting right next to me, and she complained that she couldn't smell it very well. So she decides to blow on the joint to make it burn more brightly, at which point it explodes in the cop's hand, and we all sit there, stunned with a slight contact high, as we watched marijuana ash rain down on every member of the RA staff of our building. We're promptly told to leave, so I go and I go to get ready for Bible study, not thinking anything more of this. And I get in the room, I'm setting things up, I'm getting the Bibles out, I'm arranging the chairs, and my friend James walks in. And under one arm, he's got his Bible, and under the other arm, he's got this jumbo pack of double stuffed Oreos. On his face, he has got this wide, dead-eyed smile. And I go, hey, James, how's it going? Are you okay? See, yeah, I'm good. Yep, I'm good. I broke my hand today, but it's okay. They gave me some Vicodin, and I took one. I took a few. And do you ever just look at your hand? Just really look at it. And I realize that even though James has walked through the door, I'm still very much alone in the room. And in a few moments, a bunch of little wide-eyed freshmen are going to file in, and they're going to sit down and expect a profound study on Romans 4. And I'm going to have to hide the fact for an hour that my best friend is high at Bible study. So everyone comes in, we sit down, we get started. My plan becomes just don't let James talk. Just fill all of the silences. Don't leave any, you know, open moments. Just jump in whenever there's a second. And I do a pretty good job. We get about 3/4 of the way through, 45 minutes in, and James has gotten loose a couple times. He's you know, kind of quoted about the end times in Revelation. He's talked about the proper way to sacrifice a goat in Leviticus. But beyond these, I can see the light at the end of the tunnel. We're gonna make it. This whole time, completely oblivious to the fact that I smell like I've been hotboxing for 5 hours before this. So the terrified little looks I see the freshmen giving them each other isn't just for James, it's also for me. And we get to the end, I'm just about to wrap things up and lead us in a time of prayer, and when to my left, I suddenly hear, and I look over at James, and he's taking the jumbo Oreos out of the pack one by one, and he's airplaying them into his mouth. He sits there and he smiles for a second, then, and I realize that my dream is dead. This is not going to be a profound year of diving deep into God's Word together, because no one's ever going to come back to this. We finally finish, and I break, and I say, guys, I'm so sorry that tonight was so weird. James broke his hand, he had too much Vicodin, and James doesn't even recognize the fact that I've said his name. I say, and in a vital moment of realization, I say, oh, also, if you guys smell anything weird, I tell them the story of the cop in the basement with the exploding joint. My friend John is sitting across the table, looks at me, says, Justin, thank you so much for saying something. Before you did, there was no way any of us was coming back. Evidently, they were all very relieved to learn that only one of their Bible studies leaders that night was high on drugs.
I love that. And, you know, the idea of merging Vicodin with Bible, those two words alone, has got to be a winner. I love that story. You know, my all-time favorite story, and I don't mind saying this because this is the truth, is your story about the baseball star in your class.
Oh, yeah.
Okay? Mm-hmm. Now, you told that story here a couple of years ago, yeah. But I want to make an offer to all three of you. I want you to write down your favorite story. I will get it on Facebook. And RD, I want you to do that because I want everybody to get your contact information as well. Will you do that? If you have it in writing, send it to me. I'll get it on Facebook.
Love to.
Sure.
Okay? Please do that. Please do that. You know, next week, I want you to have a great and healthy, happy 4th of July. And then I want you to join guest host Eric Heen, who's going to lighten things up a little bit with tales to make you smile. Not that tonight's didn't, I'll tell you. Tonight's were great. Thank you, R.D. Vincent, Amanda Wenger, and Justin Dice, for your favorite stories. If I could be so bold, I also wanted to summarize exactly what we mean by a favorite story. Amanda said transformation. Justin said closing. R.D. said originality, right?
Yeah.
Three key terms. I love it. And I want everybody to remember that because storytelling rocks. Thank you to the three of you for your signature styles and your passion for story. You were on today. You were on before. And I can promise you, you guys are going to be on again. Stay exactly where you are because Lars is up next with a sweet mix of singer-songwriters on the Tennyson Tape Deck. Make 90.1 a part of every day. And while you're driving home, turning in for the night, or just chilling, join us every Thursday at 8 p.m. for So What's Your Story? And treasure what you hear. You keep loving great stories, and we're going to keep bringing them to you. This is Dr. Hank, and along with the rest of the So What's Your Story team, we never want you to forget that it is never too late to live happily ever after. Peace.
If you decided to donate your birthday to KPFT this year, thank you. If your special day hasn't yet arrived, consider donating your birthday to KPFT. Here's how it works. Facebook sends you a prompt before your birthday asking if you'd like to donate your birthday to a nonprofit. Select KPFT as your organization of choice. Then add a personalized message so that your friends know how much KPFT means to you. On your birthday, they'll receive a Facebook notification asking them to make a donation in your honor to KPFT. Thanks again for supporting 90.1 FM KPFT Houston, Pacifica Radio for Peace.
KPFT's 2019 Local Station Board election is underway. A donation of $25 by June 30th gives you the right to vote. Want to do more than donate? Consider running as a candidate to serve on your local station board. Visit elections.pacifica.org and cast your candidacy by completing the nomination package before June 30th. E-ballots will be issued to members with an email. Members in need of a paper ballot can email NES@pacifica.org or leave a voicemail at 510-854-9663 indicating their full name, address, and telephone number. Please help make this election green by filling out a ballot request form on elections.pacifica.org indicating the email you would like us